War doesn't end when you leave the battlefield. The hardest fight comes after service. Identity, purpose, and tribe. Where do you stand when the uniform comes off? This is where we talk about it. No bullshit, no filters, just real stories from those who've been through it. This is the Great Guns Podcast with your host, James Scott.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Great Guns Podcast. And today's guest is a gentleman by the name of Jeff Bodell, who served active service as a Marine reservist in the United States Marine Corps. Welcome, Jeff. Great to have you on.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Brilliant. So, Jeff, obviously, we need to start at the beginning. How did you end up being in the reserves for the U.S. Marines?
You know, as a young child, I always looked up to people in the military. And as a kid, when you see grown-ups out there in their uniform, they look sharp and, you know, there's something honorable about their service to their country. And I thought about the Army and the Air Force. I watched too much Top Gun as a kid, thought the Navy would be cool to be a fighter pilot, like Tom Cruise. But I remember seeing the silent drill team when I was probably about 4 years old, the Marine Corps rifle squad of the drill, and just thinking that was really cool. You know, as I got older, and then 9/11 happened, and being a teenager during that time, I think your mind is very mendable and malleable and can be swayed by, you know, the media and the patriotism and the pro-war, you know, Dick Cheney stuff, I guess you'd say, that was going on in the United States at that time. And, you know, it seemed like it would be a good idea for me to go serve. You know, when I was 18, I was like, I wouldn't mind going to Iraq or whatever. It seemed like some cool, grand adventure at the time for, you know, a 17, 18-year-old. And, but I was going to college, and I told the guy I'm gonna go to college. I went to a Marine recruiter. I said I want to go to college. A lieutenant colonel told me about this officer training thing that I can do during the summers as a college student to become a commissioned officer. And he said, "No, you don't want to do that. You want to go active duty and you want to be infantry and go to Iraq." And I said, "Well, no, I want to go to college." And he just kept telling me to go active duty infantry. So I realized he wasn't listening to me. And I just went to college. I said, "Well, I guess the military is not for me." So I went to the college orientation day. And there were some guys in their uniforms behind the table that said Army ROTC. And I was like, "What's this about?" And they're like, "Well, yeah, you be a student. And when you graduate, you'll be a lieutenant and we'll pay for your school." And I said, "Sign me up. Sounds pretty cool." So I started doing that and started hanging out with those guys and going to a lot of ROTC kind of drinking parties. And one of the guy's roommates was a Marine. And I was like, "How are you a Marine and in college?" I was told I can't do that. And he said, "Oh, no, there's the reserves." So the next morning I called a recruiter and they drove me 3 hours away to go swear in and enlist as a Marine reservist. So I was a little bit impulsive, but that's what I did, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, you did try to do it the way it should be done, but, you know, I wouldn't have thought that's impulsive. So what the audience might not know is that you've actually written a book called The Warfighter's Lounge as well, obviously, from your experience when you were on active service. So can you just let us know how it led up from you being in college to being a reservist to getting off and actually seeing active service? Because, you know, as a reservist, people tend to think you don't necessarily get called up. You're not necessarily the ones going up to see active service. So how did that come about?
Yeah. So my service, like a lot of people probably say, is a little bit unique because there's no one cookie cutter path for military service. Yeah. So I was in a special program called the 92-day reservist, which means they have 92 days a year to train me. And then I have to go back to college because I'm a full-time enrolled college student. So I'd have my fall and spring semesters at the university. Then during the summers, I would go do boot camp. And then the next summer, my MOS school, I would be a military police officer. And then the summer after that, I went to Marine combat training, which was like 28 days of basic combat stuff, which most of the people that go to that training, they're 10 days out of boot camp. I was 3 years in the fleet, and that made a big difference for my experience. Because I got treated like I was a recruit again. And yeah, I was pretty miserable. But and then right after that training, they said, hey, we need a platoon of MPs from my company. We had three platoons. So they picked kind of the people they wanted to go, I guess. The high physical fitness tests, the high rifle scores, the people they knew weren't going to be a discipline problem. It was kind of like a NFL combine draft. And I got selected on that. I volunteered for it as well. And that was to go to Afghanistan. This was my company's first trip to Afghanistan. And we were going to support another military police company. And long story short, their deployment got scrapped. So we were fully trained. They attached us to another unit to deploy with in Afghanistan. And then the day we got in Afghanistan, my platoon of MPs said, see ya, we're not working with you. And they found missions for my platoon. They split us up into five or six teams throughout Afghanistan to be embedded with Afghan police officers. That was a new mission for the Marine Corps at the time. And they said, oh, we got 40 Marine MPs. Perfect. We're going to make you do this police officer thing. Nobody really knew what it was at the time.
Did that make you feel like it must have been quite something to go from college to finding yourself out being I suppose you guys were police mentors for the Afghan National Police Force.
That's correct.
So that must have been quite a thing, quite a change for you mentally.
Yeah, I mean, it was honestly really exciting. We were happy to have like a gung-ho mission where we're out there doing Marine stuff, not sitting in a tower watching the desert. Realistically, even though we were reservists, the guys I served with were pretty top quality folks. I'd say probably half the guys I served with are police officers. Most of us have college degrees. And there's a little bit of difference between the kind of person that joins the reserves versus the active duty. When we enlisted, it was the height of like two wars, Iraq and Afghanistan. So you knew you were probably going to go fight if you enlisted in the reserves, because contrary to popular belief, the reservists actually get deployed a little more often than some of their active duty counterparts, because the active duty counterparts have a role to fill on the bases or the divisions that they're at on their bases and during the states, where the reservists, they're not filling a role. So if you deploy them, you don't have to replace them with somebody else logistically. So yeah, it was, we were excited. We wanted to face the enemy. And I know I wanted to, because, it goes back to 9/11, where it's my whole teenage years, my early enlistment, they said, oh, you're going to Iraq. Before I went to boot camp, I had to meet with the first sergeant from my unit. And he said, you will go to Iraq and you will die. And then he told me to get out of his office.
It's okay. Yeah.
Well, that was my welcome to the Marine Corps speech. And, you know, even at the time, it's like, what were we doing in Iraq other than Dick Cheney and Bush and weapons of mass destruction that nobody found? Afghanistan, we wanted to go there for, you know, payback for 9/11.
Yeah.
That was the mentality at the time.
Yeah, no, 100%. It's just interesting, two things you've said there about your first sergeant and the recruitment. It always amazes me that we scream out, and same out in the UK, we're desperate. Well, I say desperate, but we're wanting to recruit people, and we want to recruit the best people into the armed forces and that. Yet we have people on the front line that often are, and I'm not going to sugarcoat it, that are often just fucking dickheads. They're just, do you know what I mean? Like that.
Yeah.
It's all about them, or they just give you some speech where you just think, well, why am I even bothering? And I think we lose a lot of people. Luckily, yeah. We don't always, but
I mean,
it sounds like your experience.
Yeah, I definitely think there's a reason why there's so much retention loss during the global war on terrorism, because who would want to stay in when the entire culture is to treat everybody like a dick? And if you, I know the Marine Corps I served in is different than the Marine Corps that exists today. You know, if you had mental health issues or anything, like, you were expected to bottle it up, suck it up, and Charlie might continue the mission. Because if you went and tried to get help for yourself, you were viewed as somebody that wasn't dedicated to the Marine Corps or the mission, and you were expendable. And I don't think that's the mentality that exists today, which I think is a good thing.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, you're getting people who are humans out there doing things that need to be done. There's going to be consequences mentally wise, not just physically, but you got to look after them. So you think that's changed then in the U.S. Marines?
Yeah, I think so. Just from what I see on social media and talking to people that serve now, also not just Marines, but the Army. My wife is a therapist in the Army. She's a commissioned officer, and she's currently deployed into a combat zone now. And she tells me about all the people that ask her openly and come to her for mental health services. And I was like, we never would have done that. That would have been a cardinal sin to say I need help when I was in, you know. So she's telling me that it is, in fact, quite a different environment now.
Yeah, but that's a good thing. You kind of understand, I suppose, where they're wanting everyone needs to be kind of almost to, you know, block things like that out of their mind, because they've got to think about what the job is and what they need to achieve without the distractions. But it's inevitable. People aren't going to be able to box that out always.
Mm-hmm.
Not everyone can do that. So, Jeff, you went out Afghanistan. How long were you deployed out there for?
It was about 9 months.
Okay. So,
about Valentine's Day, so February 2010 to late September 2010, I believe. And I was in a city called Marja. During the Battle of Marja.
Yeah, which for anyone listening, that's kind of the, your book covers one day of that experience, isn't it? Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. There's enough stories out there about people's service and their careers, and no, but at least I don't want to read another book that talks about boot camp, because it hasn't changed in 80 years, you know? And that wasn't the point of why I wrote it. Really, my book is an experience. If somebody wants to experience what I experienced in one day and one patrol, one facing the enemy, and what it was like, that was the goal of my work, is just to share. It's not even really about me, because while it was how I perceive things, it'll be similar for just about anybody in combat, even though everybody has a unique experience. But yeah, it's a book. It takes place on July 27, 2010. And that was the day where one of our team members, Lance Corporal Abram Howard, was killed in action when we went out to go find the Taliban. And then it covers the last half of the book covers the, I guess you would call it, like, the emotional and psychological and physiological effects that experience had on me immediately after.
Is the reason you wrote the book, was that just you wanted just to share that, or was it kind of also a bit of you looking to kind of put that to bed and working your way through those feelings, those emotions that are tied to that event, or what was it? Well,
the reason changed and morphed over time. Because when I first wrote down the very first pages and started it, from the time it was a physical thing that somebody could buy, it was about 12 years.
Wow, okay.
So it started with me working night shift at a psychiatric facility, watching patients snore all night and thinking how miserable I am working there. And then at nighttime, watching people sleep, you have a lot of time to think. So I'd often think about that day and try to relive it and process it and all that. And I started to realize, you know, as the years went by, my memories of the events would start to fade. So what I did was I wrote everything down. Anytime I had a memory or a visual image of what happened that day, I'd write it down in as much detail as I could. And eventually I had this narration of the events and what I felt and what I thought, what I smelled and saw, and I started organizing it. And then I started calling my friends that were there that day and be like, hey, I remember X happening, but did Y happen before X? And started piecing these puzzles together. So it started as just me wanting to document the day for my own reasons, just to remember it. And then I started thinking, you know, maybe if I keep working on this, I could have something that could be read by somebody else and it wouldn't be a jumble of thoughts. But a big reason after that why it morphed into a different reason to write it and to continue was for the family of Lance Corporal Abram Howard, because I knew what they were told by the military about how he died, and it wasn't accurate. And I'm not going to say it was a lie. I just think somebody didn't know, and they just repeat what they hear, and it changes over time. So the official story of how he died, I don't think reflected my experiences of how it happened. So I wanted the family to be able to learn my thoughts and views on that experience if they wanted to. And then keep working on this thing. And eventually it morphed into something where, hey, I think a large group of people would be interested in learning about this experience. I think it could help other people as well. So.
Have you had any feedback from people where they've said that they've read it and felt they'd gleaned something from it? Did his family ever, do you know if they've ever read it or know the story, your story?
Yeah, I still talk to his family a good bit. And his mother, I know, read it. One of his cousins read it and they talked to me. As you can imagine, it's probably a hard thing to do to pick up a book and read in extremely gruesome grit and detail how your son was brutally killed.
Yeah.
But yeah, I have gotten quite a bit of feedback from people I know and from strangers. I've had people say, hey, I work at the VA for 23 years with veterans. Thank you for writing this. And I now am able to understand my patients better and their experiences, since they don't necessarily share these details. And several of the spouses of the people I write about reached out to me and said, you know, thank you for telling me what my husband went through.
Yeah.
This explains so much. He's never talked about it. And when he does, it's just, you know, the tips of the waves. So
kinda, just the service level stuff.
Yeah, so I kind of gave him a behind the curtain view of what we went through. And also, it's pretty nice when there's somebody's like, you know, you captured their mannerisms and their personality so well, even if you didn't have their name on them, I would know exactly who was who. And so from a literary point, I took that as a pretty big compliment. But yeah. Even spouses of people not in the book or spouses of my coworkers or other friends, they send me messages, reach out to me and say, you know, the same thing, like, thanks, this really helps me understand my husband, an Iraq war veteran, better. Because I did try to give a unfiltered view of my emotions and psyche through it all.
Yeah. No, brilliant. Did any of the guys you served with, did any of them, you know, if their spouses came to you and said thanks for that and because it helps them understand, did any of them have that sort of same kind of feeling that they were glad somebody could express that to their spouse? Because it's hard for people to talk about the trauma that they went through, but then when someone close to them knows about it and has a better understanding of it, there's a possibility for healing a lot easier than general understanding of each other.
Yeah. Even some of the guys I served with, you know, they reach out to me and they're like, hey, thanks for writing this. Or, you know, it really explains a lot. You know, I didn't see all that. Or especially the stuff in the back where I talk about some of the issues I faced, like I couldn't sleep and I was hallucinating and losing my memory. People are like, hey, I had no idea you were going through that at the time, but I was too. He's like, I couldn't sleep for days after somebody else got hit in a different attack. So even though we lived together in the same tent and we worked with each other every day, all day in combat, we still didn't know what each other's were going through or how they're handling it. Because, you know, you got to continue mission. So you got to bottle it up and compartmentalize and keep going.
Yeah. Were you married at the time?
No, but wait, I had a girlfriend who is my now wife.
Oh, okay. Okay. So had she seen the different side to you after going through the book, like knowing what you've written in the book and stuff, or was she aware of that kind of around the time that it was all happening?
I think she's pretty aware of it. She's a pretty smart cookie. She's also been the mental health professional for many years now.
Okay. So it sounds like you had the right support at home.
Yes. Yeah, she's great.
So you mentioned there that you did go through a rough time, as anyone would expect you did. What helped you get through all of that? How did you process that whole thing? Because you said you were there for 9 months, then I don't know if it was from a conversation we had or was it in the book where you went, like you were in a war zone and then you're back on a college campus within a short space of time.
Yeah.
How did that whole process, how do you handle that?
Not well, mostly at the bottom of a bottle.
Okay.
So active duty, I guess, when you deploy, you come home, you go back to your unit and you're with the guys still. The reservist, you have that option to extend a little bit and stay. But I was in such a bad place mentally where at the time, stupid me thought the best thing I could do was just get away from the Marine Corps. So we got home. I spent 3 days in Pittsburgh at my unit on active duty. And I said, see ya, I'm bouncing out. And I had 3 months where I didn't have to report or do anything. So I spent 3 months eating cheeseburger subs and drinking vodka and beer and watching reruns of the X-Files. And if I could change anything about my military service, it would be that I would have stayed with my guys longer and that support there instead of cutting them all off and going back to civilian life. So, yeah, I was back and being Joe Schmo civilian within weeks of being shot at by a sniper in Marja. I remember sitting in, and then I started college classes pretty much right away because I had one semester left to graduate. It ended up being two because PTSD and depression and alcoholism, I really did not excel those last little stint of my college career. But I remember sitting in a class and the two guys behind me, they were talking like it was the biggest event and the most difficult time of their life. And this challenge that they were trying to figure out how to overcome. And the challenge is, how are we going to get 3 kegs of beer when all we have is a Jeep Wrangler and for their party that night? And I remember just being so disgusted and so mad at these two kids where their greatest issue in life is, how are we going to get our beer to our party when, you know, I was in some pretty harsh stuff just, you know, weeks or a month before. But yeah, it was several years of just not doing well, following it up, not using proper coping mechanisms.
Yeah.
At one point, I did go to the VA hospital, at the Veterans Affairs Hospital over here, and I kind of told them, like, I'm not doing good. And they're like, well, we don't do walk-ins here. And I was like, well, they told me you did. And so I went in and they're like, well, we're not going to let you go home in case you're suicidal. And so they did a screening of me. And then she's like, okay, yeah, we're going to get you a doctor. So eventually I made that first step to go in, get some treatment, did that for a little bit. And then I had a little bit of a falling out with the VA hospital system because, you know, I guess I was young and had a chip on my shoulder, but I had some less than pleasant experiences of some staff there talking down to me and saying I was a liar. Like one example was I have GI issues. I lived with the Afghans, so every time they got sick, I got sick. I had dysentery for 36 days.
Jeez.
And it was bad. And I told a medical doctor, not even like a nurse, I told a doctor about this. And she's like, you're lying. Nobody's gotten dysentery since World War II. Like, that doesn't happen.
Yeah, but that's because she doesn't know where you were, like what people are like there.
And she's like, you have no medical records of this. I was like, excuse me, you think I was just going to walk to an aid station in the middle of Marja? Like, I lived in a mud building.
Oh, yeah, it's that ignorance of not knowing. So, yeah.
But, so then I, you know, leaned on my wife pretty heavily for a few years and wrote this book as a thing. But recently, in the last couple of years, I'd say I went back to the VA and started doing regular mental health medical treatment through them. I recommend it. There's different options there for anybody. It's like I said, it's not the same military or the same Marine Corps that I served in. For anybody that's listening out there, it's in the States. The VA of today, the VA medical centers of today is not what it was 15 years ago. So
yeah,
much, much better.
So are you still seeing someone for it? You're still working through it?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I got 3 kids. I'm trying to be a good dad and a good husband. Yeah, just regular checkups, making sure I'm doing all right. Because at this point in my life, I can recognize the red flags of a downward spiral. But some people might ignore it. Or may not see them all. But I think it's just better to cut it off before those red flags show up, you know?
Yeah. What was it that kind of, when did you recognize that something's really wrong? I mean, might sound like a bit of a silly question. I mean, obviously, if you're just drinking yourself to sleep every night, that sort of thing, you know something's wrong. But when did it kind of dawn on you that, hey, hang on, I've got to do something about this? Was it that time when you were sat when the two lads at the back were having
kid problem? There's just a lot of times, right? You know, even that time in college, I was walking across the quad and I was getting close to this big stone statue that somebody donated, an art sculpture. And I heard this whistling because somebody threw a little whistling Nerf ball. And I thought it was like a mortar, a rocket. And I dove and hid and got so embarrassed. I just went home for the rest of the day. And, you know, there's another time I went to get tires changed on my car and somebody across the street was shooting a gun because this is America and everybody has guns everywhere. And I hid behind a stack of tires and, you know, it just... a lot of stuff like that, but then that might be the extreme. But then the stuff you don't necessarily notice is just the sense of anxiety all the time. It probably took me 5 years after my deployment until I could walk around the corner in like a hallway, like a normal human being. Because what I would always do is I'd poke my head out first, and then my body would follow because the body's a bigger target.
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
It's hard to shoot your head. And I'd always, every 2 steps, I'd turn around because I was always the tail man Charlie of the formation looking behind me. Like stuff like that is just habits. It took a couple of years. You know, the things that are hard to notice are like the irritability, you know, just generally feeling anxiety, the sleep problems. So when, I don't know if there was a certain time, but I noticed the most recent time, like I feel like I'm doing all right. I just have a hard time focusing, paying attention, and just feel like anxious, sleep issues. So I just said, hey, maybe this is worth talking to my doctor about. And it was, and you know, I'm doing much better now.
Good. No, I'm glad to hear. I mean, obviously, and this is what this whole podcast is about, is helping veterans and sharing their stories so that we can help others. So it's good that you're there. I do often find it amazing how long it can actually take guys to get to a stage where they go, right, this has got to change. Like you were mentioning, like 5 years, like another chap I know, it was like 7 years before he actually hit rock bottom to be able to then go, actually, this has got to stop. I need to do something. And you think 7 years, 5 years, a long time. You know, a lot can happen in that time.
Yeah. And for me, that like 5-6 year mark, that was like really bad. Anybody from the outside viewing me should know like that guy's got a problem. But like now 14, 15 years later, it's like there's still something there, you'd have to recognize it in yourself.
But something like that's never going to go away. I mean, it's in here. No. It's locked into your memory. You can't just erase that. I mean, the world would be a better place if we could sometimes erase some memories, wouldn't it? You know. Question for you though: would you do it all again?
Absolutely.
Even with the same outcomes.
Yeah. From, you know, people say the proudest moments of their lives when their kids are born. Or something like that. Like I have 3 kids, you know, they're great, love them. But for me, thing I hold most dear to me is my experiences of fighting shoulder to shoulder alongside my fellow Marines. It was a great privilege to be able to do that. Lots of downsides and negative outcomes from that, you know, death of some pretty great people. And personally, I take like 8 medications a day now just for my respiratory system because it's so messed up from that crud in Afghanistan, the moon dust and the burn pits and everything. And not to mention the psychological and emotional effects, but yes, I would do it again. I think the only thing I would change is I would have tried to stay in longer. I left the Marine Corps when my contract was up. Yeah. I said, peace out, I'm done. And CEO at the time, first time I ever met him, he's like, why are you leaving? And I said, because I feel burnout and I just can't do this anymore. And I feel like the Marine Corps would be a better place without me. Now, many years later, I realized that was, you know, combat stress and PTSD and depression.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
So okay. the only thing I would change is I would try to stay in.
Yeah. And you think that would have helped you because you had people around you that understood?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, which makes sense. But then the worry is that if you did stay in longer, you could have been called back up again and, you know, re-exposed to sort of that environment again, which
I wanted to
could
do
have
that.
Changed things. You did.
Yeah. I figured it would be better if it was me than somebody else that, you know, at the time it felt like I was already tainted. I was already damaged because of it, so just send me out instead of damaging somebody else.
Okay. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Oh, which I get, and I understand that. But yeah. Okay. What would you say to someone coming through that kind of scenario? What would you say to them that you might think was a good idea? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing that my friends say too, and unfortunately sometimes we say it too late, but I figured you'd probably ask a question like this, so I didn't want to be a hypocrite, so I called some of my friends this weekend that I served with just to say, hey, how's it going, man? Love you. And so you just reach out to that support network we have, right? We look out for each other on the battlefield, and it doesn't stop there. We haven't worn the uniform in over a decade, but we're still brothers. So reach out to your friends, the guys you served with and the gals. Even if you're not having a hard time, you never know what they're going through. And unfortunately, we lost one of our guys last year to suicide. So really hoping that doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah, it's one of the biggest things is that exactly that. People just don't know what people are going through. And often people go, oh, it was completely by surprise. It's because people don't share and don't know, don't notice. But I think if you're touching base with people often, you might hopefully notice the change. Something might trigger a thought going, hang on, he's in trouble. So you guys, who you served with are still quite close. Do you get to see each other often, or is it just
kind of phone calls? You know, being in the reserves, we're generally geographically located pretty close together. I live a little further away than some of the other guys, but you know, the unfortunate event of Lance Corporal Abram Howard being killed in action, I think bonded us together in a way that we didn't expect. And a large part of that is because of his family. Every year on the anniversary or near the anniversary of his death, we get together and have a little memorial reunion, you know, party. 14-15 years ago, it was a bunch of 20 somethings getting drunk and shooting guns and being crazy. But now a little less crazy, less guns. You know, there's kids that show up to these parties that we've had, and marriages that have been had since then, and kids that are named after Abe Howard. And it's nice to at least see each other once a year, if not more.
You just mentioned there that there's families and marriages and that. Do the incoming spouses, do they get it? You know, do they understand what it's all about? Or is it?
Yeah, I think so. You know, a lot of the spouses, you know, they're newer or they've been there since before deployment. but it's kind of like a, how to say, like a, an extra family, you know?
Yeah.
So it, yeah. It's almost like a family reunion at this point.
Which I think was, you know, from considering what everyone went through in that family, as you say, like that get together and that support, you can't lose with that.
Yeah. My wife's been going to most of them, you know, when she's not deployed, but she noticed on the, I think it was the 10 year anniversary that she's like, this is the first time any of you have openly talked about Abe's death and what happened that day. So I think there's a lot of healing that goes on there at that yearly event as well.
Yeah. But they say that as well. Talking about it does, even if the other person can't solve the problem, but just the fact that you can talk about it is a good starting point to the healing process. It just kind of going back when you were talking about writing, you know, you've written stuff down because your memory was failing about what specifics went may have gone on that day and so on. Do you think that as a form of journaling, do you journal at all or not, just out of interest?
So this might be a little bit vain, but when I deployed, I was like, you know, this could be my opportunity to write like a cool book. Who knows what's going to happen? Because I think the greatest piece of literature ever created was With the Old Breed on Peleliu and Okinawa by Eugene B. Sledge. And he created that because he illegally journaled in his Bible during his campaigns in the Pacific. And because he kept those notes, he was able to make his book that those decades later. And I read a lot when I was younger, especially military memoirs. One Bullet Away, there's another one, Navy SEAL, where it was like, what you mean I can't kill him? Audie Murphy's The Hell and Back, even if that was to sell war bonds or whatever. But it seemed like most of these books I read, the people were like, I kept a journal. So I thought, maybe I'll keep a journal and that'll open up the opportunity for me to write something. I journaled for 3 days. I have 3 entries. And then I said, fuck this, I'm done. It's too much work. I'd rather go watch Spartacus on my laptop or play an N64 emulator or sleep.
Yeah.
So the beginning of my book is one of those 3 journal entries.
And do you do any of that now still, even after you did the book and everything else? Do you write anything down?
No, but I did recently start writing fiction. I've discovered that I just enjoy creating writing. So yeah, 3 little projects I'm working on now. Coming? Yeah, hopefully. Depends how fast I write it. It probably is. George R.R. Martin might have his next Game of Thrones book out before I get this one, but we'll see.
Yeah, well, you must let us know if you do get it out. We'll keep an eye out for that. That would be brilliant. So nonfiction would be interesting.
Yeah, well, this one I'm working on now, it's going to be fiction. It's going to be like military sci-fi. So that way I can try to relate some of my experiences to a fictional setting. Might make it a little easier to share some stuff.
Well, okay, brilliant. That sounds great. You know, I'd be interested to see that. But like I did admit to you, I'm only a quarter of the way through the book, or at least I think I'm about a quarter of the way through the book. And I'll still get there, but I've enjoyed listening to what I've heard so far. And obviously, there's a lot still to come. So I'm going to give that a good go. But I will in the bio put a link to where people can get your book. I'm assuming Amazon being the kind of prime spot.
Yeah, Amazon or pretty much anywhere else that books are sold. If you don't like to give Jeff Bezos your money, there's other options out there for you.
Well, yeah. No, exactly. I mean, yeah, well, I'll go down that road. So what's the future hold for you then? Moving forward, thing, you know, you're doing the work, like new book, and then, well, you got like 3 kids, I think you said. So yeah. That'll keep you busy.
Yeah, you know, I volunteer with Cub Scouts with my kids, and I just try to continue my life of service to my country. As corny as that may sound, I truly believe in it.
Not at all. Not at all. We, you know, more people that do it, the better the world would be, you know, just putting themselves out there for service for others. So what would you do? Like, one of the questions then is, what would you do if your kid comes to you and goes, Dad, I'm joining the Marines. How would that go down?
Well,
actually,
if it comes in a few years, sorry, what were we saying?
No, I was just saying, actually, because you've got ex-US Marine and you've got US Army in the household, don't you?
My wife and I talk openly. We kind of joke that we hope our kids do something smart, like join the Air Force, so they can be treated a little bit nicer than, you know, myself. But no, I'd be lying if I said I don't like kind of fantasize about one of my kids maybe potentially joining the military, specifically the Marine Corps. I'd be extremely proud. I'd be proud of them no matter what they do. I get it now as a parent. Like, if we were in the middle of two wars and one of my kids is like, I'm going to go join the Marine Corps so I can be the first to fight and get in there, and I would not be happy. I'd be worried, but still probably proud. You know, there's a little bit of reflection on that later in the book, too, with a little disagreement my father and I got into when I decided to enlist. At 18, you're like, whatever, Dad, I'm going to do what I want. Yeah, you know, after seeing and befriending Gold Star family members, I get it now.
Yeah, it is difficult. Like, my daughter wants to join the Army and serve. And it's nothing to do with anything that I've put on to her, pressurized her into, or anything. It's just that's what she's decided. And my wife is like, yeah, but I don't want her to go to war. And it's like, well, you're joining the frontline service. But then we can't stump what our kids want to do. And we just got to be there and make sure that the decisions they're making are good, solid ones founded in research and a true understanding of what's coming if they do go down that road. I think that's all we can do, and then be there for them.
That would be the big thing. Is every time I ask somebody, you know, why are you joining the military? If your answer is like, oh, so I can be a soldier, so I can be in the Army, like, you need to have a reason that's good for you. And I also think that enlisted especially need to understand that they are a tool to be used to exert the will of the United States. You know, I've been in combat, done all the cool guy stuff, even as a reservist, and I never protected anybody in the United States. That wasn't what I did. I served the economic and political goals of the United States government.
Yeah, yeah. No, exactly. You got to make sure that you understand what it is that you're doing and where you're going with it. No, 100%. Cool. Well, thank you very much. Really enjoyed the chat. And it's nice meeting you online. I know we had a conversation on the phone and stuff, but I'll look out for the upcoming book. Might harass you every now and again, going, where's that book? Where's the new book?
Please do keep me motivated.
I won't. I'm only joking. I'd never do that because I don't like people pressurizing me for things.
A little bit of pressure and stress isn't a bad thing.
No, it's not. And that as long as it's control, like, you know, you've got control of it and you can manage it 100%. No, but brilliant. I will put a link to the book, or at least put the book's name up and everything. And if anyone wanted to connect with you, where's best?
Instagram and I think there's a Facebook page are the main two things for the Warfighters Lounge is the account name.
I actually forgot to ask you, why'd you call it the Warfighters Lounge?
Well, for about 10 years, the title of it was Andy Wall, which means friend in Pashto, because that was the first word typed into the Word document. So it auto-saved as that. So I had to think of a name, and, you know, at first it was the Spartan, because that was the nickname of the guy who was killed. And then it was the route donkeys, because that was the road we were on, and it all just sounds kind of, I don't know, like pompous or something. So I was looking at pictures of our little living area, and I wrote about it in the book. We had this canvas, or not canvas, but the camo netting, or a little sunshade area, and that's where we would hang out outside our tents. And one of our guys took a piece of cardboard out of an MRE box and wrote the Warfighters Lounge, and then in parentheses wrote Combat Action Marines Only on it, and hung that up. So we had a little name to our little living area, and it seemed pretty fitting, because that's where we spent all our time, and our camaraderie was there, and it's where the book starts and kind of where it finishes too.
So I think it really does pay homage. So I know, it's brilliant. Cool. Jeff, thank you very much. And yeah, I'll get all your links in the bio down below. So if anyone does want to reach out and have a chat, they can. Yeah. So again, thanks very much. And I appreciate you taking the time out to join me.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate the chat.
That's a wrap, folks. And a big thank you to our guest. Remember, keep moving forward. The fight's not over until you decide it is. Till next time, stay bold, stay fearless. Live life like it's too short for half measures. This is the Great Guns Podcast, signing off. And remember to subscribe to join our tribe.